Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the second day of the class, the course on successive themes in the Buddha Dhamma. Last Thursday, the first day, we started our very first topic, that is enlightenment. So we were able to discuss only the one word only, Buddha. Now we started so on purpose I skip certain references from Pali Sutras because I never wanted to get it much longer. So because we will come across these Pali terms again and again. By the way, so I'm also recording it on my iPhone. So that last week I was able to record it, and then as I shared with some people using Gmail, so it was very much very easy. So it was the phone converted into a voice memo, and I could very easily share it. The good thing about this, when the class is not more than 1 hour and a half, so that is the good size of the file that I can share with everyone. So Amal, he's also recording from today onwards. Thank you very much for that. Now, so the first theme that we started last week was enlightenment, or spiritual enlightenment, to say it more specifically. If we use a Buddhist term, that is awakening. So those who want the last week's voice record, please give me a Gmail address. Afterwards, I can send it to you. So many people suggested that I should have this on Zoom, but somehow on medical gowns, and doctors also asked me to avoid the screen, small screen, big screen, everything as frequently as possible, because I'm having some eye problems now. So that's why I never wanted to have it as on Zoom. So we did discuss, we started the theme. Under this theme, enlightenment, our purpose, we would explain what the triple gem means in Buddhism. Just like in Christianity, you believe in the Trinity. Hindus also believe in three gods. Like Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara. In Christianity, you believe in the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. In Buddhism, we believe Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. And we did discuss Buddha. Those who missed the last week's class, please, when you give me an email address, so when you go home, please listen to the first one, because all these topics are successive. So that we are all connected. However, unlike the last three courses that I taught during the last 8 years, this is going to be very slow moving. I'm going to do this at so slow pace, and you are welcome to ask questions not really pertaining to the topic. There could be other general questions as well, because this is an open-ended course, kind of perpetual. So no question is, or every question that you ask would be pertaining to what we discuss here, because this is a very broad class. Now, today we're going to talk about the second term, second part of the triple gem, that is, as you know, Dhamma. So, first word is Buddha. It comes from, you came here, should be mindful of that. Okay. So the first word is Buddha that we talk about, and today's is Dhamma, Dhamma, Dhamma. And each word, each non-English or Pali word that I pronounce, I would also spell the words for recording purpose. So the So the word Buddha, Buddh, it is derived from the root Budh, to awaken. And also the word Bodhi also comes from the same root. That's what we discussed the last week. And today we're going to talk about the second term, that is Dhamma, that is Dhamma, Dhamma, the English term of which is Dharma. So, however, Dharma, while you are free to use the word Dharma as English speakers, but at the same time, Dhamma is specifically Pali. Now, Pali is a Middle Indo-Aryan language that Buddha used in his teachings. It is derived from Sanskrit. Sanskrit is the ancient Indo-Aryan language. Pali, or many other, there are a few other languages that the Jaina Mahavira use, Maharashtri, and all those, they are Middle Indo-Aryan languages. Sinhalese is the only Middle Indo-Aryan language that grew outside of mainland India, that is in Sri Lanka. But in the 6th century BCE, Pali or Magadhi, it was an international language. So people could communicate in Pali. Now, we would, in this course, we would use the word Dhamma, Dhamma, rather than Dharma. Because Dharma, as in English, it's a Sanskrit word. It is widely used in other Indian religions as well. It has different meanings. According to the Buddhist commentaries or Attakathas, so Dhamma, it has a specific meaning in the Buddha's teachings. Buddha borrowed the same terms that were in use and he reinterpreted them. That's how you make technical terms, right? In science, in engineering, you use the general English words and you redefine them in a way to mean something specifically. So the word Dhamma, it is derived from the root dhru, dh, diacritic mark, dot underneath hr, dhru. So it's almost like you pronounce drew, dhru. So this is dhru, however. This is dhru. So dhru literally means to hold, to support, or that which forms a foundation. Now, the definition of Dhamma is that Dhamma helps you, supports you, it prevents you from, it gives you a foundation that would prevent you from falling into hell or adversities. Hell is more like a religious term. Whereas a more acceptable psychological term is adversity. So Dharma is what is that which holds you, prevents you from falling into adversity. So Dharma here is taken in an ethical sense. So that's what Dharma means. So as I'm talking in English, I run relevant Pali phrases in my head. So sometimes maybe you might see the little pause in my talking, my explanations. That's because I recall those relevant Pali phrases and they run in my head. So that is Dharma. It is the whole that helps you from falling into, to prevent you from falling into adversities. The standard term that you come across is Niraya or Apaya. Niraya or Apaya. N-I-R-A-Y-A. Niraya. Or A-P-A-Y-A. Apaya. So when you get the recording, you can run it back again and again. You can memorize the word. That's way better. We can save time rather than using to get every word on the board. Now, Niraya. N-I-R-A-Y-A. Niraya. Next word, Apaya, A-P-A-Y-A, Apaya. Now, Niraya, that's how you form this word, Niraya. Ni, N-I, plus I, N I ni, prefix ni, plus I, Y A I. I think that's good for the Pali pronunciation class as well here. Ni I, ni plus I, ni is a prefix. I means ace, A-C-E, ace or joy or happiness. Ni means completely devoid of, zero, completely absent of. And apaya have the same meaning, is a r plus aya again. A means also absent, zero, complete, devoid of, zero, nil. Aya is the same word then. A plus a y a aya. Ni plus aya, a plus aya. Ni raya, apaya. Aya means ace or joy or happiness. Where there is zero happiness, there is apaya or niraya. So that is the word, ni apaya. Now, while religion talks about hell in different ways, even Christianity talks about purgatory, right? Purgatory, because some believers are not qualified to be called back home, to be union with God according to Christianity. So that because they were too sinful to be reunited with the divine, so that they would be sent to a particular place somewhere, and that's called purgatory, just to go through some sufferings. In Greek Roman religions, in Buddhism, in Hinduism, in almost every, even in Native American religions, in ATR African traditional religions, I studied like 12 religions because I teach all of them. So they were, all these religions talk about a kind of afterlife existence where sinners have to go through repentance, go through suffering, dukkha, if you use the Pali word, dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A, dukkha. Now, dhamma is that which prevents you from falling into hell, purgatory, or the apaya. Now, in Buddhism, we usually use the word in a psychological sense. Now, elsewhere in the future, you will come across when we talk about certain terms, and Buddha never wanted to be his teaching an ethnic version or a cultural version. In order for his Dhamma to be universal, he has encouraged us directly and indirectly to talk about that look at the Dhamma from a psychological standpoint. Because when you look at ourselves, because we come from different cultural, religious, or ethnic backgrounds. However, we have the same mind, all the conditions, right? Can you label anger as Christian anger, Buddhist anger, Hindu anger? No, right? These are cultural things. We all get angry. We all live in peace. We have kindness, compassion, anger, jealousy. So, and that's one of the other reasons in the future lessons we will discuss that. But always, every time possible, he avoided, other than, except in conventional, very conventional teachings, Buddha would always deconstruct the individual, the persona, personality, or Puggala in Pali, P-U, G-G-A-L-A, Puggala, P-U-G-G-A-L-A, Puggala, mean the person, into Nama Rupa, N-A-N-A, Nama, R-U-P-A, Rupa, Nama Rupa, meaning Nama is the mind, Rupa is the body, the mind-body, and he reduced individuality into a mutually supportive, mutually affective, two different mechanisms called nama, mind body, the mind and the body. But in the Pali Sutras, we rarely use the mind and body as one word, two word, two. We use it. It's a one word in Pali, in sutras. That is very fascinating to say that the mind body. That's what Buddha calls it, the mind body. So mind and body are written as one word. So because, just to give us how our body and mind, our corporeal reality and psychology, how our body and mind functions as two different systems. Now that is that idea. Nama Rupa is widely used in writings on mind-body health. So as we discussed last week, even Nirvana or salvation, as it is taught in the Buddha Dhamma, it is a cognitive process versus a cosmic process. That's what we talked about last week. It is a cognitive process rather than a cosmic process. All the sufferings are within. A way out of suffering is within, and the path is within. Salvation that you achieve, that you earn, is also within. It has nothing to do with the cosmos. It has nothing to do with the stars and planets and heavens. Even though in Buddhism also we believe in heavens. And so given the time we have just a long list that we have to go to today. It looks like it will take us at least 3-4 sessions to get a fair understanding of the triple gem. It is not as simple as Buddham Saranam Gacchami, I go to Buddha for refuge, I go to Dhamma for refuge, I go to Sangha for refuge. It's not that simple. But in rituals, we simply say that, hey, Buddham Saranam Gacchami, I go to Buddha for refuge, so I'm a Buddhist. It's not that simple. It's not that simple. So even if you don't say the phrases, even though you don't memorize those phrases, it is something within. So that is why in Buddhism, there's no conversion. Buddha utterly condemned conversion. Instead, he talks about what is called transformation. We need to spiritually elevate ourselves. Ethically, morally, and spiritually, we need to elevate ourselves. It is a private thing. While you can have Buddhism, or I am Buddhist label, whatever. But still, I have come across a lot of Buddhists, people who are born into Buddhism who call themselves Buddhist, and when I speak, when they are not, some of them may are not everyone, whereas I have come across, met people who practice the Buddha's teachings, and I have met them in different countries. They hadn't even, the first time I met, they hadn't even seen a monk, they had never been to a temple, they had only seen a statue of the Buddha online. Right? Or they had listened to teachings on YouTube. So that is when, because the Buddha Dhamma is something universal. Where, as far as when you look at his teachings from a psychological standpoint, you will see the universality of it. That's the point I want to make. Whereas when you look at it from a in terms of ritualism and ethnic or cultural identity, that's when it becomes Buddhism, Buddha plus ism. Right? Ism is always a dogma, a belief. As I just said for fun last week, some Westerners call, say, they say to me, Panthe, I practice Buddha Dhamma, not Buddha dogma. Why? Because Buddha never talked about dogma. Nothing dogmatic. It's all about, and in his teachings, Buddha never uses any theory. He simply explains our psychology as it is. He simply explains our body as it is. He simply explains the physical world or the natural world as it is, and the universe as it is. How we remain inseparably interconnected with the nature and all that. How we are deeply affected by the compassion and jealousy of others equally. How far we are able to keep ourselves unshaken as possible in the world that is always shaken and chaotic. So that's a private thing. Buddha Dhamma, practice of the Dhamma, is a private thing, but at the same time you can do group practice as well. But simply because you join a group that you believe is practice higher Buddha Dhamma, even though you can become a member of that group, but I wonder whether you would benefit from that. Because sometimes, people practice religion for prestige. I met a lot of people for prestige. I practice this dhamma, okay, I'm part of this organization like that. So whereas you are free to remain affiliated with organizations and all that, but at the same time, when it comes to the practice of the Buddha Dhamma, it is private, it is personal, spiritual thing. Now, Dhamma again, is it clear? Any questions about Dhamma? Dhamma.
Perhaps give a couple of examples of how the meaning that was specific in the teachings and how
Right, yeah.
differs from
Yeah, so
the
yeah,
previous.
thank you. Yeah, how the Dhamma specifically used in the Buddha Dhamma, right? So I'm just repeating
What the other meanings might be.
meanings. Yeah, right. So while Dhamma, the root is general, this is the universal, the derivation of the word. So in the sutras, how it explained is, it is explained in an ethical sense. Now, how you prevent your in terms of the Noble Eightfold Path. Noble Eightfold Path. That is the third, fourth part of the Four Noble Truths, Chatu Ariya Satcha. That is where the path is. So we will, for now, we wouldn't go through the list. The Noble Eightfold Path is, that is the spiritual path that someone aspiring to become enlightened must follow. Noble Eightfold Path. Thank you. And also on daily basis, you are encouraged to voluntarily undertake to observe some Sikkhapadas, Sikkha, Sikkha dash, Pada, Sikkhapada, or training principles. You are encouraged to undertake to observe these Sikkhapadas, or training principles. They are not quite commandments, even though in general Buddhist practice you come across different sets of precepts, Sikkhapada, so training principles. First, the set of the five training, the five precepts, eight precepts, 10 precepts, nine precepts, 10 precepts, 228 precepts for monks and monastics. There are different precepts. Now, so Dhamma, as you when you follow the path of the Dhamma, so again, Dhamma is the path to enlightenment, then you live your life as moral or as ethical as possible. By that's how you walk the that's how you practice. And automatically, I think you don't have to be Buddhist to do that. When you never destroy someone's life, when you don't steal, when you don't commit fornication, or you remain faithful to your partner, when you don't lie, so when you don't drink in the way that you lose your sanity and you become harmful to do things, you would tend to do things harmful to yourself and others. Like when someone get drunk, he could easily become a criminal. By hitting someone, by raping someone. So that's when you observe those training principles, you can ethically elevate yourself. So that so that's then there's a guarantee that guarantee is a self-imposed guarantee. You have to build that guarantee for yourself so that you don't go to jail. Now, if you talk about hell or purgatory, so you never get thrown behind bars, right? So why? You never committed any crime, when you walk down the street, stroll down the street, and the police car is coming, they don't simply catch you because you are not a wrongdoer. A wrongdoer lives in his own mental hell. That's what Buddha says in different places. People, those who commit mistake, those who are guilty, they constantly go through dukkha, mental dukkha. They already live in this body itself, they live in hell. That's why they have already fallen into adversity. Then you are guilty. Whereas when you practice the Dhamma means, so now that prevents you from falling into adversity or hell. So that's you are clear then. So that is how Dhamma is. Dhamma needs to be understood. So like in but in Some people tend to recite it. We all recite at the beginning of meditation, at the various outsets of meditation, gathering, in puja, know that we always say Buddham Saranam Gacchami. I go to Buddha for refuge. I take shelter in the Buddha. Dhamman Saranam, I take shelter in the Dhamma. Sangham Saranam Gacchami, I take shelter in the Sangha. And then some people would simply say it, but that wouldn't mean anything to them because they don't mean it. They are not serious about it. So, and the next word is Sangha. Any question? Okay, thank you for that question, right? About the Dhamma? Yeah.
It's still related to the Dhamma. It seems like that foundation of the Dhamma seems to have many levels, right?
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
On the surface, we practice the practice.
That's right, exactly.
If we memorize, we start by memorizing, but then we're like, okay, I memorized, but what does this mean? Then I find the meaning, but then, oh, okay, but there's different meanings, there's this meaning, but then.
Yeah, each precept is to be practiced on different levels. You're right. Different levels, yeah. Even the same precept. For example, let's say, when you say the first precept, Panatipata Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami, I undertake to observe the precept of never destroying life. For example, some people, they say this, okay, I observe, I never kill human beings. No murder. And some people say, okay, I run, I am in beef business. That's in Alberta, where I live many years, in Calgary, Alberta. Alberta beef. And they work for beef. I know some butchers who come for meditation. And they say that, I help them. They say that, I still butcher cattle, but I have never butchered a human being. And there are different levels. So that's why always it's very difficult to elevate yourself. Ethically, but there's no such thing that you become like saint enlightened overnight, because you are bound by different obligations, responsibilities, maybe job related. So I know some of my butcher friends in Alberta. They are very good friends of mine, but sometimes when there's a two well-known butchers. They came for my Wednesday meditation there. Some people didn't like their presence. And they were just communicating with the body language. And I look at them without letting them know. I said, because they were going to say something. And later, two of them later gave up their butcher's job and they started working for a meat factory. And then, say 7 months later, they went to a vegetable farming in the neighboring state, province, Saskatchewan. I never asked them to give that up, but they voluntarily decided to have a different life. So that's the kind of motivation that gives you. When you done based on your own motivation, not simply because someone asks you to do so, so that you live with that motivation, sometimes you find another way to survive too. So that's how, so that is when there's no conversion then. It's self-transformative. Dhamma is a path for self-transformation, not self-conversion. If I had I kicked them out of the temple because they were butchers, right, I would have done something very un-Buddhist, right? When I very unethical, because they themselves had a problem with, because they want to survive. They had been butchers for all their life, but later they got motivated to stop that job and they switched their, left their employment and they went to the meat factory. Then they moved to vegetable farming. So that's how, because I never asked them. I asked all the people, come in, don't talk about their profession. They came here for mental peace, probably. They will be peaceful. They would stay like, they wanted to have a peace of mind. That's why they came to the temple for the during the meditation time, the 2 hours, and they would practice. And later they decided to leave their job. Up until they came, voluntarily came back and told me, hey Bhante, we decided to change our jobs. And I simply say, ha ha, no, please ask us. Please, because you are a friend. Please, what kind of job is, you know, in the West, we never ask you about your job or salary. No, no, please, you know what? Okay, then let us tell. We just switch our jobs completely. We now work in vegetable farming. See, that comes from motivation. So always, ethical, personal, ethical transformation or moral transformation is a personal thing. It should come from, unless it comes from motivation, through motivation, you will find your life in spiritual life in kind of jeopardy. Why? You are doing because somebody is asking you to do so, because of imposition, because of kind of commandments. So that is what the Dhamma is. You voluntarily practice. See, one of the when Buddha lived, he spent most of his vassas, most of his years, lifetime in what's called the Jetavanarama or the Jeta Grove Monastery. If I am correct, maybe he spent there like 24 years or so, some 20 years. And his next door neighbor was a butcher, a pig butcher. So and he has a pig farm. Early in the morning, he would hear the people are screaming in fear, pigs screaming at night also. And Buddha tried to speak to him, but he would hate the monks. So one day, years later, one early morning, or in the evening, maybe in the early morning, he heard Buddha and the monks heard him screaming like a pig. And then monk said, "Oh, sir, he's another one, as usual in the morning." And Buddha said, "No, it's not a pig screaming in fear. It's him. He's dying. He's dying. That is his voice." And then Venerable Ananda or someone approached the Buddha and said, "He has been your next door neighbor, sir. Why were you not able to help him?" And Buddha says, "I tried. Everyone tried. But he was not willing to do that. But there are certain we can impose. We can impose. We can simply motivate people, guide people through. There's no way that because a Buddha wouldn't do a policeman's job. So that we don't catch people and put in jail. So the Dhamma is a moral law, not the common. It's not the law of the land. So the next one is Sangha. It comes from the root SAM, diacritical mark dot underneath M, that is a prefix SAM, sum with diacritic mark dot underneath M, plus HR, diacritic mark dot underneath H, sum hru. I myself have difficulty pronouncing Huru. HR Hu. Sang plus Huru. That's the root. Now, the root HR Huru means to gather, to be comprised for a specific purpose, like assemblage. So, to be comprised. But even to this date, it will require a lot of explanation when we come, because Sangha in India also use the word Sangha, right? Sangha is a Hindi Sanskrit word. Sangha. Sangha means a community. So it literally means community. Now, however, Buddha gave a specific meaning, Sangha. That's the next thing we're going to talk about. There's a bunch of Pali terms. Now, no, this is according to international Pali alphabet, M as a prefix. Whereas when you write Sangha, then you drop M and then instead you write N. Yeah, Sangha. But as a prefix, it's Sam. Sang. Here, diacritical mark dot underneath any underneath M is pronounced like NG in English, singing, dancing, running. So sang plus her. Kro means to gather, to be comprised for a specific purpose. Now Buddha gave a different definition of Sangha. A Sangha is a specific group. Oh, that sense maybe I'm compelled to use another word. That is Bhikkhu. 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 Usually Buddhist, a monk is addressed Bhikkhu in Pali. A Buddhist nun is called Bhikkhuni. Now, because I thought I should explain this because of its relevance to the word Sangha. Now, there are three universal definitions of Bhikkhu. There are two pre-Buddhist definitions and there's one Buddhist definition. The two pre-Buddhist definitions are Bhikkhatiti Bhikkhu. I'm just saying it for recording purpose. You don't know, you have to worry about the Pali phrases. Bhikkhatiti Bhikkhu. One who begs from others, Bhikkhu. But one who collects requisites, so alms, food from others is called Bhikkhu. That's a pre-Buddhist definition. And there's another one, Chinna Bhinna Patadharatiti Bhikkhu, one who wears a robe made of, wears a cut and broken robe, or a robe that is made of rags collected from cemetery. But nowadays, you can buy fancy, expensive robes and ready-made robes from anywhere. It's very cheap, it's readily available. Back in the days, so the ascetics would walk to cemeteries and they would collect so pieces of cloth that were used in which the dead bodies were wrapped. Something they would unwrap the bodies and they would get those, and some would be not clean or the new clothes, maybe some rags. Why use new clothes to wrap a dead body, right? So that most of the time it would be rags. And they would, so the second definition is those who wear a robe that is made of rags collected from graveyards, cemeteries. So the cut and broken robes. But however, even to this day, a robe is cut into, if it's a single piece, it is cut into few pieces and then they are sewn together again, just to devalue the robe at the same time. It gives a very, lesson of impermanence. Just like the robe, your beautiful existence, your life, the world, everything is fragmental. It can fall into pieces any moment. So the robe is, that's a long story, but I'm not going to repeat that because otherwise it will take 2 hours to explain the robe because it's quite irrelevant here. Yes?
Just a very quick question.
Mm-hmm.
I thought in period, it was common to cremate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some would, only the rich people would do that. Not everyone. Some people were, even to this date in India, I noticed that not everyone can afford to cremate, because it depends on areas also, because there are so many, because I visited when I was in rural India, I saw that. But somehow in nowadays, because it becomes a hygiene problem, issue with hygiene issue, people bury them, cremate, but at the same time some would bury them and some would just leave, throw into the water, and there are different ways people used. For example, I saw in Nepal, this rich person was, his while he was, I saw in Kathmandu, excuse me, it was a Brahmin, so he's a rich person. His remains were burned by using sandalwood fire, sandalwood. Whereas when down the river, I saw someone, they couldn't burn it properly because they didn't have, probably they had firewood. So, and then they just push it to the water, into the water. So the burial, or throwing it into the forest, in cemeteries, it was a very common practice even to this day in some. That's why we inherited that ritual from India. In Sinhalese, there's a way, there's a special, even in rural areas in Sri Lanka, they don't simply discard the dead body in the forest because it's illegal. However, we sometimes use a word, especially in, I come from a rural Kandy. Still some in the old villages, they say, Kale Gahanawa. No, when are you going to throw the dead body into the bush, into the forest? That's what the phrase means. But actually you don't do that. Meaning, when is going to be the funeral or the cremation? But tradition, they use the word, because there was a time in ancient times, sometimes people would simply discard the body. So, and you know, in the Saw Parker's story too, Saw Parker's story, one of the, how to say, untouchable boy. Remember, he was his stepfather took him to a graveyard, and so he tied him in to a dead body. So it was very cool. There are a lot of stories in the canon and in other Indian texts, how sometimes as thieves or robbers were captured and they were tied to dead bodies. As that would be the how to say, more successful way of traumatizing someone, and they would live with the trauma. Some would even die. In fear, right? Yeah. So that's why it's a very common thing. In fact, somebody told me in a rural area when I visited India, to some one of my interpreters suggested that I go into a cemetery, a graveyard deep in the forest, where I could see some skeletons. But I didn't have time. Otherwise, I wanted to go there and see and meditate. So, and they were left for wildlife to feed. Like in Tibet, they have a practice. They feed the vultures. They would take the dead body into designated areas up in the mountain, and they cut the dead body into pieces to feed vultures. So it's a barrier. That's right. Yeah. So that's why there are different ways. Now, Sangha, when he explained, now the bhikkhu, now the Buddhist definition is Sansare Bhayang Ikkati Iti Bhikkhu. One who sees or realizes the dread or the dangerous nature of samsara or existence is the bhikkhu. One who understands, one who realizes the dangerous or the dreadful nature of samsara or existence, bhikkhu. Now, Buddha used, interestingly, in many sutras, Buddha used the word bhikkhave in plural. He addressed all bhikkhus. However, when he addressed his audience, at the time he addressed his audience by bhikkhave, bhikkhus, his audience was comprised of all ordained disciples, monks, ordained male disciples, monks. Nowadays we use a different word. We don't use the word nun. We call male monks and female monks. Nowadays, male monks and female monks. I prefer that term. Male monks and female monks, or monks and nuns, and lay men and lay women. Why did Buddha address everyone as bhikkhave? He could have addressed them, okay, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas. No, he used one word for a purpose. All these four groups of people came to Buddha for a specific purpose. Why? They were fed up with their empirical existence. They wanted a way out of their samsara. And that's when Buddha addressed them, or those who see the dreadful nature of samsara. And that's how he would explain, address them. But in the Vinaya, because the Buddha's teaching is divided in three baskets, Vinaya, that is the code of conduct for monks and nuns, monastic code of conduct, and the Dhamma, conventional teachings, Abhidhamma, higher psychological teachings. So in the Vinaya specifically, when you use the word bhikkhu in the Vinaya, it means only monks and nuns. That is, whereas when he addresses his audience in general by as bhikkhu, that means one who sees the dreadful or the agonizing nature of samsara. So that, and when he addresses that, and everyone would look at him and say, "Yes, that is why. That is what I am. That is what I am. That's why I am here. That's what I am here." And they would play that word in their head: "Bhikkhu, bhikkhu, bhikkhu, bhikkhu." So I'm someone who sees. I'm fed up with this existence, all that. So that is when, that's what's called bhikkhu. Now, when it comes to sangha here, in different places, Buddha specifically explains his sangha as a community that is very different than other sanghas. Because nowadays you can use the sangha, because I years ago when I attend interfaith dialogues, I met Jain sangha, Hindu sangha, Buddhist sangha, in Indian communities in Canada and the US, a lot sangha. So that's called sangha, means the community, and they that's the universal meaning, sangha, a group of people who gather for a specific purpose. Here, the universal meaning is sangha. It means the same thing. It's the same meaning, sangha, spiritual community. So that's why the general translation of sangha, even in the Buddha Dharma, is the spiritual community. Like, we are all sangha. But in the teachings, in when he explained the sangha as the third part of the triple gem, he explains that sangha is someone. So the ordained monks and nuns. Why? Because this, here's the reason. Now, Buddha is gone. He no longer lives in the world. He passed away, and his Dhamma is here. Now he created the Sangha. He specifically ordained Sangha. He had the Sangha to take over the duty of sustaining or maintaining or protecting the Dhamma. As a specific group, for that purpose, they have to be ordained. So that is the reason. However, in the universal sense, you are the Sangha. We are all Sangha. Why? In terms of that Buddhist definition, bhikkhu, those who see the agonizing nature of samsara existence. How long can I live this life? If I come back, what if I go through the same or worse? So I need to walk away from this cycle. So that is the motivation that with which you walk to the Buddha, and Buddha is seeing your mind, and he would address you, bhikkhu, or come on, come over, and then so the Buddha would read your mind, and then he would teach you. So that is the meaning. So that's why, see this, see how complex the meaning is. Now, as part of the triple gem, it is ordained monks and nuns, because they are like in. Like saints in Christianity, or church, like the church. So church in Buddhism, some Westerners translate Buddha as the pioneer, and they translate Dhamma as the gospel. There's one famous book also here, The Gospel of Buddha, meaning using Christian terms, and Sangha. They say that the Church of Buddha. Church of Buddha. That is the institution. I know a lot of Western Buddhists. They use the same word, Buddha, his gospel, and his church. But sometimes those who are not familiar with those terms might feel offended too. But I love those terms. They mean it in universal terms. Now, when it comes to the Sangha. Sangha is there are four eight types of sangha in the Buddha Dhamma. That's yeah, and we explained that in terms of Maggapala, Magga, Magga dash Phala, Phala. Maggapala. It's a one word because it's Maggapala. Magga, Magga, Magga means the path. The path, the way. Phala is the result of the fruition. The path and the fruition. Meaning, Magga is the path that you walk. That is the Dhamma, Noble Eightfold Path. And then Phala means the result that you earn. That is enlightenment. Magga Phala. Now, most of the time, some Western Buddhists use this word Magga Phala. And they say, I have some Canadian Friends, they always say, Bante, we are trying to achieve some Magapala in this very life. Now, within the Western monastic community, they use more Pali words than English words. It's like a technical term, Magapala. I'm working on my Magapala. One prisoner told me in Florida. He's in jail for a minor offense. However, given, but he evaded arrest so that the judge put him in jail for like 5 years. That's why he became a fugitive too. That's why. Otherwise, his crime wasn't that grave. So when I met him, he said, in jail, jail time is my best time in my life. So thanks to the judge, he put me in behind bars so that I can work on my Magapala. And I would encourage him every time I met him. I would encourage him Magapala. So the Magga is that is the path. Pala is the result or the result that you achieve by walking the path. Magapala. In traditional English, the traditional English translation is the path and fruition, the fruit, the path and fruition. Now, Sangha is further explained in terms of Magapala. That's the four levels of enlightenment. Probably we'll have to explain the rest of the time on the four levels of enlightenment, but we would only touch on that because there will be two lessons, maybe two sessions on the four levels of enlightenment, because I may want to rush, right? I promise that this is a very slow pace. Unless you accept that when you ask a question, I will touch on that, try my best to give an answer that could be, brief answer. Now, there are four levels of enlightenment. For now, we will only touch on them in English. The first level of, and then, so, first level, each level of enlightenment is divided into two again. Is that Magga and Pala. So it becomes eight. So when Buddhist people chant the formula in adoration or in the Supatipanno, and they talk about the eight individuals, eight noble individuals that are called Sangha, meaning the first level of enlightenment is the stream enterer. Let's have carry out the discussion in English only without referring to Pali words here, because we will discuss them again. Now, here's the four levels of enlightenment. Stream entering, once returning, non-returning, complete enlightenment. Stream entering, or you become a stream enterer. You are still swimming, so you are still walking the path. You are still swimming upriver. You swim upriver, not downriver. You don't have, you have to make no effort to swim downriver. Just stay there and it will take you. You might even drown. So you don't have to, so it's upriver. You swim upriver. Now, stream entering. In order to, now, jumping into the stream and falling into the stream, two different things. When someone pushes you into the water, you might get drowned because you are not ready to do that. Whereas in order to enter the, because you need some skills to swim, to fight the waves. Some people, they swim across the English Channel. They cut across, they swim across the Atlantic Ocean. They set world records, right? So you need to fight the tidal waves of samsara. So that is called the stream enterer. That is the first level of enlightenment. In order for that, you need to overcome, you need to deal with, when you walk the path of Magapala, on each level of enlightenment, you have to deal with, cope with, remove certain number of what is called fetters, the 10 fetters of samsara. Now, I will simply go through the list, and please don't ask, you don't have to ask questions, because I'm just saying this for recording purpose. Because when you refer back to this lesson one day, so, and I will, then you will remember that. So there are these 10 fetters. What are the four levels of enlightenment? You become a stream enterer and you keep swimming. So you are still mugger. You are following the path. And when you achieve the first level of enlightenment, then the pala, the fruition. Then you become, I'm confusing you because there's no time to explain them yet. Second level is once returner. When you achieve the second level of enlightenment, you only come back to the sensual world only once. Because there are three levels, three lokas, L-O-K, lokas. There are three planes of existence in terms of our mentality, our mindset. So the sensual sphere of existence, and then material, material, fine material sphere of existence, if I use the traditional word, sensual sphere of existence, existence of the form, Brahma worlds, and then the world of the formlessness. In the second one, on the second level, like four kinds of hells, one humanity, six sensual heavens, we are sensual beings. For now, sensual beings. There are four kinds of hell in four hells, one human world, six sensual heavens. All together, how many worlds? There are 11 worlds that exists within the sphere of sensual pleasure. The only difference in the case of hell beings are they are still sensual, but they don't stand a chance to enjoy because they are too busy with dukkha, suffering. Whereas other beings in those six sensual heavens, they have access to an abundance of sensual pleasure. However, Buddha discourages us, I would say not us, he discourages me to go to heavens and enjoy. Why? Because if my purpose is enlightenment, Maggapala, there's no point going to heavens. Why? Just like hell beings are too busy with dukkha, suffering, if you go to heavens, one of the six heavens, you will be too busy with comfort. Whereas humanity is the middle realm. In humanity, you are equally, you have the ability to understand both dukkha and sukha, both suffering and joy. Because it is only within the human realm that you are able to see that joy and sadness and joy, or suffering and happiness, are the two sides of the same coin. Only within the human realm. And according to certain sutras, according like the Devata Sanyutta, a lot of sutras that Buddha gave, the teaching that Buddha gave to divine beings. And some divine beings come and see, and Buddha asks, why you came down from heaven? So I want to learn the Dhamma. I am fed up with this existence. Just like some rich people say, like affluent, right? Some rich people get fed up with their life, and I always say, these monks always refer to them. Extremely, extremely rich people, they commit suicide because they are fed up with their money, their comfort. They need more. But there's nothing more to buy. No more happiness available for purchase. So they get depressed and they commit suicide. Now, so there are some accounts of the divine beings in the sutras. And they say to Buddha that they don't like the heavenly life anymore, and they would like to have enlightenment, just to walk away from. When you repeat the same thing again and again in your life, however good it is, but you get fed up with that, your life becomes monotonous. You don't enjoy that anymore. Probably because when you take a break and when your mind is absence of that joy, probably again, after lapse of joy, probably you want to come back and enjoy again. But again, people get fed up with that. They say it's the same thing. Now, that's the nature of our existence. We are. See, remember that word. We will touch on another word the next time, probably next week, because we need to refer back to the word Bodhi again. Bodhi, did I write that? Yeah, Bodhi. Did I write that? Bodhi also, Buddha and Bodhi. Bodhi. Buddha and Bodhi come from the same root, awakening or enlightenment. That's why you say the Bodhi tree. It's not the tree of enlightenment. It is the tree under which Buddha sat and became the Buddha. So it is an icon of enlightenment. Icon of enlightenment. So enlightenment is an iconic. Tree is iconic. So by sitting under the iconic Bodhi tree, you meditate and achieve enlightenment that is an iconic. It has nothing to do with icons. So purify your mind. That's why you choose the Bodhi tree. So it comes from for the same root, Bodhi. Now, so here the 10 fetters. Did I go through the list? Stream entering, once returning. Now, those who are, that's what I was explaining. There are some, when you achieve the second level of enlightenment, you only upon death, you only come back to the sphere of sensual pleasure only once. And then when you pass away from that life, you will be reborn into the second sphere of existence. That is called the Brahma worlds. So now, again, in those who live in, if I just explain, use one particular word to go through this, because given, remember this word raga for now. Raga, raga. We talked about this word a lot in our previous classes. Raga, raga, raga. Raga means it also had a sexual connotation. Raga means lust, pleasure, sensual pleasure. In English, actually, sensual, sexual, they go together. Sensual pleasure, because sexuality forms a predominant, may how to a substantial part of sensuality. Sexuality forms a substantial part of sensuality. So sometimes, when in psychological speaking, when people refer to sensuality, what is happiness? And consciously or subconsciously, they think about sexuality too. That's what raga means. Now, raga is the It has three different words, raga. We, those beings living in those 11 worlds, four hells, one human world, and six sensual heavens. So we are always, our way of thinking, our life, our thought patterns, they all come related, they come from what is called, this is raga here, right? We have the karma raga. Kama raga. Kama means you can very easily remember that Kama is a very famous word, you know that, right? Kama, the famous sutra, Kama Sutra. Kama means sensual pleasure with emphasis on sexual pleasure, Kama raga. So we are Kama raga beings. So our existence is, our existence, our joy, our happiness is derived from Kama raga, sensual pleasure. As I said, the only difference in the case of hell beings are, they may not have access to Kama raga, but they are, by nature, they are Kama raga beings too. They seek sensual pleasure, but they don't have access to it. Human beings, they do, and those heavenly beings in the sensual heavens, they have access to Kama raga. So our identity as those living in within the sensual sphere of sensual pleasure, our identity comes from kamaraga. We always need to please our eyes, please our ears, please our nose, please our palate, tongue, please our skin. When we are not doing any of those five things, we close our eyes and we become very psychotic. Psycho. We recall our pleasant experience, and then we relive those memories. Or in case those memories are agonizing, and again, still you accept them. In fact, you embrace both comfort and discomfort. That's how we are. That's when elsewhere Buddha refers to our, by he explains our behavior as, you accept, you collect gold, at the same time you collect trash too. Garbage too. Why? Because we grasp both joy and happiness, both joy and sadness. However agonizing a certain mindset, a feeling is, the first thing we do is we embrace it. Then we complain. So, first we embrace it, first we accept it. There's no way else to, we find it difficult to reject. Reject an agonizing pain or a painful feeling right away. First we accept it. First we embrace it. Then we define it. Then we become hateful of ourselves. Why did I believe in that? Why did I say that? So that is when, so that is the nature of kamaraga beings, those who live within the sphere of sensual pleasure. Now, going back to that word, so the stream enterer, and stream enterer would get reborn up to seven births within the sphere of sensual pleasure. He should only seven times. Within these seven times, he would attain, that person should attain other levels of enlightenment. However, if you attain the second level of enlightenment within this lifetime, you will, upon that, you will only come back to the sphere of sensuality just once only. What will happen to then? During the second birth, and you will be reborn, you will either become attain some other levels of enlightenment. If you die before you achieve the complete enlightenment, then you will be reborn somewhere else. For example, so the sphere of rupa raga. Rupa. Rupa means form. Now, there are 11 Brahma worlds. 11 higher heavens. In those heavens, beings don't enjoy kama raga. They don't have sensual pleasure, but they still seek pleasure out of their form, their body existence. That's called rupa. Rupa means form. They still love their existence, but they don't seek sensual pleasure. They simply love their existence, their form, their Brahmakaya, meaning the Brahma body. They don't have any sexual feelings, no sensual feelings whatsoever. So, you know, in Christianity, how God is depicted, right? All white hair, you know that, so the traditional image of God. So Brahmas are also kind of depicted, in, that is the image of Brahmas in arts. In Indian in arts in the sub-Indian subcontinent, so he looks like a wise man. Brahmas are depicted like wise men because they don't have any sensual pleasures. They live in meditation. They are meditation devas, in other words, in simple language, they are meditation gods. They live in meditation. They don't enjoy any sensual. They don't have, but still, they still have raga attachment to form. They still want to make a long story short. Otherwise, this takes like 7 weeks or so. But anyway, we'll come back because this is relevant here to explain the Sangha here. Now, Rupa. And above the 11 worlds of the form, there are four worlds of the formlessness. Now, in order when you do good things in your life, you will be reborn in one of those six sensual heavens. If you earn what is called jhana, Jhana, jhana means psychic ability, psychical absorptions. The word originally come from Sanskrit, dhyana, dhyana, dhyana. In Pali, it is jhana, jhana, jhana. In Chinese, when it to chi into China, it's become chan, ch apostrophe an, chan. And when it come to Japan, is Z-O-Z in American pronunciation, Z-O-Z-E-N-Zen. It comes the same root, dhyana, jhana, chan, zen. So, and that only means the mental purity. Now, those who practice rupa jhanas and they are upon death, they will never come back to humanity, sensual worlds. But you don't have to become an enlightened person. You don't have to achieve the first level of enlightenment or the second level of an enlightenment to go to these worlds. In case you still achieve jhanas but never get enlightened, but still upon that you will be reborn into those Brahma worlds because of your psychic power. But however, our description is along the line of enlightenment. Now, there's another group of people, spiritual people, human beings. They practice meditation. They are not interested in body either. So that, however, they still want to exist without a body. That's called arupa. A means not. Rupa means body. Arupa, formless. There are four words. When someone passes away, having achieved arupa psychic powers, arupa jhanas or psychic absorptions, they will be reborn into one of those four higher heavens or Brahma worlds of the formlessness. And you will get your mind, your consciousness frozen for an indefinite period of time, up until you run out of your jhanic power, up until you run out of psychic power. And then again, you will come back to, will end up right within the sphere of sensual pleasure. However, if you have both, so now Buddha discourages practitioners to go into the third one, Arupa Loka. It's okay to practice the Rupa Jhana. Why? When you achieve Rupa Jhana, but not a level of enlightenment, ever you leave this body as an average person, and you are reborn into Brahma world, but you are not an enlightened person because of your jhanas. You are reborn into the Brahma world, and it is okay because you have access to the Dhamma. You can still practice. Whereas if you go further and achieve the jhanas of the formless jhanas, and it would be very difficult for you to come back to the body because you will remain in those worlds for an indefinite period of yes, yeah. After the fourth jhana, yeah. So after the fourth jhana, then you can further continue, and then you can give up. You lose your interest in form, and so that you only get interested to live. To exist in the mind only, mentally only. So that's your craving, your attachment to formless existence, or the pure exist in the pure form of consciousness. And when you die with that, you will be reborn into one of those four worlds. So arupa. Now the whole point is not to explain this world because we will come back. The whole point here is. Now, when you practice Maggapala, and Buddha encourages you to not to think about Kamaraga, not to think about the Rupa Raga, not to think about the Arupa Raga. Why? Those are still part of samsara. Maybe you could become a very powerful Brahma, but still you are a samsaric being. There's a how spiritual humor. spiritual humor, because I always talk about this, my Hindu friend. They never get offended because it's a joke, Hindu. So sometimes, so one, in fact, one of Professor Sharma is one of my professors in Canada. He the one who told me the joke. He's an academic. He told me that Bante, Brahmas don't like to go to Sri Lanka or Thailand. Why is that? When they land in the, at the immigration, and the immigration would ask, why are we here today? Well, we are going to reside in your country permanently. No. You cannot, there's no permanent positions available. All positions are samsaric, only temporary. If you can stay, can stamp your passport, but you can become samsaric Brahma, not cosmic Brahma. So Professor Sharma told me spiritual, because he taught spiritual humor. So that is how even the highest Brahmas are considered samsaric beings. They have to, sooner or later, they have to come back to samsara. So that's why enlightenment is highly recommended. And Buddha always places the lowest level of enlightenment above the life of a Brahma. And somewhere in the say Pathavya Ekarajena Sagasa Gamanenama Sabaloka Dipachena Sota Pati Palangwaram. It is so the position of a stream enterer is far greater than being the king, the universal monarch for the entire earth, to becoming the king for the entire universe. So why? Because positions you lose, and you might end up in dukkha again. So whereas when you achieve the first level of enlightenment, is way better than the position of a universal monarch, becoming the god king chakra, and saggassa gamanenava. It is far better than going to heaven. Saggassa gamanenava. Sabba loka adipachena is far greater than becoming the monarch for the entire world, universal monarch. That's how I explain. See the psychological explanation of all the Buddha's teachings are explained in a cognitive, in a psychological sense, not a cosmological. But Buddhism itself talk about cosmology too. Buddha talks about cosmology, and there's a whole set of belief in cosmology in the Buddha Dhamma too. So there are higher devas, but in his conventional teachings, and Buddha says how that in conventionally he would say someone must be lucky to go to sensual heavens and enjoy comfort there. He doesn't deny that, he doesn't downgrade that, he doesn't discount that. But if your purpose is enlightenment, then you may not get interested in going to heaven. That's the whole point. Otherwise you are free to go to heaven. If you want to come back to humanity, do that. If you want to go to the highest heaven, the sixth one of the sensual heavens, you are free to go. And Buddha says, whether or not you plan or wish, based on the good things you do, you will go there. And Buddha praises heavenly comfort in his general teachings. However, if your purpose is enlightenment, then become part of the Sangha. The Sangha, there are 8 people then. The Sangha means those who are walking the path to stream entering, or those who have already completed swimming, and so they have already completed swimming upriver, and so they have already entered the stream, and they did it, they made it. Or you can achieve, follow the path, Magga, of the toward the second level of enlightenment, and you can become once returner. You will only return to humanity, sensual pleasure, sensual sphere of sensual pleasure only once. Or if you achieve the third level of enlightenment, you will never ever come back to, and if you but still you didn't achieve become an arahat, or didn't achieve the complete enlightenment, you will not come back. You will be reborn in one of those spiritual Brahma worlds. By the way, that's another word. Sensual heavens and spiritual heavens. The Brahma worlds are called spiritual heavens. And the other 6 heavens are called sensual heavens. So in spiritual heavens, you only love your body, but you don't have any pleasures. You are not a pleasure seeker. So if you become a non-returner, achieve the third level of enlightenment within this lifetime, and you will not come back to the sphere of sensual pleasure. You will be reborn in one of those spiritual heavens, and there, now that you have achieved all the third level, and you will become complete the last level of enlightenment, you become an arahant and you become fully enlightened in the Brahma body, and you will pass away from there.
The non-returner is born in what's called a pure abode.
Pure abode, yeah, exactly.
Where
pure abode, thank you. So there are five pure abodes. That's called, you know, when you go through the list of Google for the 11 Brahma worlds, the topmost five are called the pure abodes. Aviha, Atappa, Sudassa, Sudassi, Akanitaka. They are called the five pure abodes. Only those who are enlightened have achieved enlightenment and some levels of enlightenment, especially anagami, non-returner state, and they would be reborn in those pure abodes. In fact, the pure land Buddhism in Chinese. The idea of pure land comes from the pure abodes in the Pali teachings, the five pure abodes. So they are all, that is the five topmost spiritual heavens, pure abodes.
Are the levels of enlightenment necessarily connected to the heavenly worlds? Or in other words,
not necessarily.
May a person
no.
achieve enlightenment without even being aware
of. Yeah, that's right. You could, yeah. Why Buddha explain, Buddha puts emphasis on these heavens? Because when you get addicted to pleasure seeking, you wouldn't be able to walk, get rid of that, and so that it wouldn't be very hard for you to become enlightened. However, Buddha doesn't impose you to go to achieve enlightenment. He simply explained that he simply explained the risks. So actually, it's always risk management. That's why just like I mentioned last week, Buddha doesn't use the auxiliary verbs like should and must. He never says, you should, you must observe the five precepts. Instead, he would say, you would, you may, you might. It's up to you. So nowhere, except in the case of monastics, because we live a specific life. We are supposed to abide by rules and regulations, so that in there you say it, Buddha says you must, because you are an ideal group. You provide guidance to other people because you are part of the third triple gem. So that's when you're there. Monks and monastics are supposed to abide by rules and regulations. Those are in the Vinaya, in the Buddhist code of monastic code of conduct, and also codes of conducts mandated by, approved by different monasteries based on the monastery. For example, when I go to a monastery, the first thing a monk should do is to look into, study the code of conduct that we, the monks, have to abide by in those monasteries. The first thing is we take a full day to talk to people and what are the, to see what the code of conduct is. So there are specific codes of conduct based on the monasteries, but there is a general universal code of conduct. There you, the Buddha uses the word should, must. Okay, that's the end of for today. See you next week. See you next week.